Normally, gardeners and homeowners focus their energy on helping their plants to thrive. This year, it's all about keeping them alive. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Jeff Iles, professor and chair of the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University, will be here along with Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. We'll talk about how you can reduce stress on your plants in this very stressful summer. We'll also talk about designing landscapes with water conservation in mind. In the insect world, it's been a bad year for mosquitoes, but there are other insects that are thriving in the dry conditions. We'll find out what they are. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and even though a large part of Iowa got a little rain relief this week, gardens, yards, and crops are still severely stressed. Here with me today, Jeff Iles, a professor and chair of the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming back to the show. And Donald Lewis is also here today, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
And we have to start with the drought today. I know that we've talked about watering on this show, but it's just ugly out there.
It is. We're speechless. things are mostly brown, it is disappointing. But the good news is that our landscape plants are fairly resilient. We'll find out who the weak ones are. But with a little rain this fall, and with hopefully a lot of rain this fall, the landscape should spring back to life. But there are some things that we can do, and I'm sure we'll talk about that this morning.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, we have, as I mentioned, we've talked about watering. But even, for example, in my yard, with our best efforts, we planted a bunch of trees this spring, which turned out to be a bad mistake, but we've already lost two lilacs and a fruit tree.
Yeah.
And even though we've tried and tried, what can we do to reduce stress on the plants in our environment?
Right. Well, when you consider that those plants that you purchased and installed this spring are an investment in the future, then it makes sense to protect your investment. And therefore, at the first signs of dry weather this spring, we probably should have been out helping these plants. Remember, newly installed landscape plants have rather small root systems, and so their ability to take up water from the soil is reduced. They're transpiring, that is, they're losing water through their foliage when it's windy and hot. So you're really fighting quite a transpirational battle. So frequent watering and timely watering is really the magic elixir. It's maybe not a very sexy answer, but it's the best one. And during these weather conditions like we've had, Charity, watering daily is sometimes what we have to do. I know that doesn't make us happy when we see the water bills come through, but these landscape plants, the woody plants, are perennials that we want them to live for hundreds of years if possible. And so getting them off to a good start with proper watering and mulching will help conserve on soil moisture, are two of the best things we can do.
And of course, most of us, our lawns have turned brown. That's nothing that we necessarily need to worry about, right?
Well, I'm not a turf guy, so I've been accused of being rather callous as it pertains to our turf grass friends. But right, it's amazing how resilient the lawns can be. They look pretty bad right now, but many of them will regreen. Dave Minner, who's our extension turf grass specialist, tells us that we should be watering lightly every once in a while just to keep the crowns hydrated. I love that terminology, keeping the crowns hydrated. But as far as regreening them, that's kind of a losing battle with the transpiration rates being what they are and the temperatures being what they are. So, and my water bill can't handle keeping my lawn green. So I'm going to let mine turn brown, and hopefully it'll recover in the fall.
Right, and we've of course seen municipalities starting to say we really can't have people watering their lawns either.
Right, I don't want to be called out by my neighbors. So maybe a brown lawn is a sign of or a badge of honor or something like that. I don't know.
The thing that stuns me though, as I drive around or ride my bike around, is how well weeds can perform even under these horrible conditions. Queen Anne's lace looks lovely this year, and ragweed is still tall and green. It's kind of mind-boggling how those plants can do so well when most of our landscape plants just can't.
Well, when you think about the weed, and I'm using that in a generic sense, a lot of these weeds have very extensive, very deep root systems, and they're survivors. They're tough guys. They've been around for eons, and they have these extensive root systems, and they're just built for tough environments. That's why they survive in some of these neglected sites. So, yeah, if we could breed some of that into our turf grass plants, we'd be millionaires.
Or if we loved ragweed as much as we love other things. This is the kind of year, though, that does make a lot of people think, maybe I need to start rethinking my landscape. If I have a landscape that requires a whole lot of watering, maybe that's not sustainable in the long term. What kinds of things should we be considering?
Well, Charity, I don't want to get crossways with the turf grass professionals in the audience, but I think one of the best things we can do, especially if we're planning a landscape, is to think about function. Think about how we're going to use our landscapes. Now, if we have dogs, if we have kids, then turf grass makes great sense. But if we don't, or if we want to reduce the amount of water we have to apply to the landscape, then planning a landscape with turf grass that has a function. You know, maybe you want it in the front yard. Maybe you want it some in the backyard where you recreate. But I think, you know, dividing our landscapes into water use zones makes very, very good sense. And so zone number one, which might be a high water use area, is an area where the annuals are, perhaps the turf grass is. Zone two might be an area where we have some shrubs and trees. And zone three, which is low water use, are areas that we just simply turn the water off during these times of drought. So if we can plan a landscape around function and about how we might triage or divert the use of water, then we can have kind of a plan when weather conditions become challenging, as they have been this summer. And of course, we've talked about using proper trees and shrubs over the years. That will help reduce the amount of moisture needed. And then, of course, if we can tie plants together into mulched beds, that also will help reduce the use of water. Now, if we inherit a landscape, then we can still do these things. We can retrofit a landscape or simply decide where to turn the irrigation off when conditions become challenging. But it's really, maybe triage isn't the best word, but it's a useful one, because we can kind of decide where we want the water to go and where we're just going to decide not to water.
Rain barrels, of course, are something that we've talked about in the past. I have many friends whose rain barrels have run dry this summer. But again, that's a great way to think about water conservation and using the water that is just going to run off of our landscape.
Sure.
Right?
And that is contingent upon rainfall. And we finally got some the other night. But if it doesn't rain, then your rain barrel, you can, I guess, put annuals in it and plant it. But,
a lot of them are really big. That doesn't sound that practical.
But you're right. We can take advantage of that moisture that sometimes hits the pavement and runs off down the street. So I like that idea. And using appropriate plants. There are some plants that we know just are a little more sensitive, are more drought prone or drought. They just don't handle the dry conditions. And it's the old adage, you know, using appropriate plants, native and introduced plants, that they don't require as much water to keep them alive.
Donald, I've been enjoying this mosquito-free summer.
You're welcome.
Right? Thank you so much for that. What does that tell us, that we really aren't seeing mosquito populations? Obviously, we know that we haven't had rains where the eggs would hatch. But mm-hmm. What does that tell us about the winter that came before?
Well, it tells us that the winter had no effect at all. That back in the spring, after we had enjoyed a relatively mild winter, there was this general feeling that, oh, it's going to be worse this year. There are going to be more insects because they didn't die in the winter. And what we said is, you have to wait and see. And when we waited and noticed that there was no standing water, there were no water impoundments where the mosquitoes could breed, even though they may have survived the winter in good shape, they didn't have conditions for reproducing. And insect populations are determined primarily at the time of reproduction, not necessarily in the dormant period that preceded reproduction. So the mosquito is a great example of how a little change in the weather, although this year it was a great big change in the weather, how these changes in weather can cause fluctuations in insect populations.
Are there insects that have thrived in the dry conditions?
There are some. The there's this little insect that is bothering some people. We haven't had a lot of reports of the false chinch bug. False chinch bug is a little brown insect that you may not recognize as an individual, but when you look across your vegetables, your flowers, your landscape, and you see a gazillion of them, that's a technical term, of course, when you see a gazillion of them, it dawns on you that this, I haven't seen this before. Well, I have seen it before. I have seen it three times previously in my career. This is the fourth time in 35 years Wow. that this insect has made an appearance, largely because of the dry weather. A better known example that has been favored by the combination of weather conditions this year is a very, very old friend, the box elder bug. And the box elder bug goes through ups and downs related to weather. We've always had this notion that somehow when it's warm in May and dry in July, the box elder bugs have a better chance of reproduction. Well, this year they hit the trifecta. They hit perfect conditions for both of their reproduction periods. And already people are calling and asking about these huge masses of box elder bugs that they see on their trees, their on the ground, on the sidewalk, and so forth. Right now, the box elder bug is in its nymphal stage. The immatures are bright red, but people are seeing massive numbers of them, which just makes me brace for the worst that may come this year with more box elder bugs than usual.
What makes you brace for that? What do box elder bugs do that might bother people?
Well, they beautify the landscape
right.
with their bright red colors, and they feed a little sap from a variety of trees and shrubs, and then come fall of the year, they go into their hibernation seeking mode, and they wander to the house, they crawl in to hibernate, and they bother us, annoy us, they are a nuisance for all fall, winter, and into the following spring.
But they're not going to defoliate our trees, and they're not going to bite us.
They do not bite, they can't sting, they don't carry diseases, they're not a pest of people and pets and property. They may be stressing those maple trees upon which they feed on the sap, but if they are, it's not noticeable. Box elder bugs are on all kinds of trees, primarily the entire maple group, and not just the box elder bug in the box elder tree in the maple group. But no, I don't think they're a pest of the tree. So mostly it's the annoyance they cause in the fall of the year that brings them to our attention.
All right. And they're causing a lot of delight for my 4-year-old son right now. So.
Let him play with them. And
you can drop them off at our house. He'd love to keep a large collection.
It's a good lesson that these things that are brightly colored are often trying to tell us something. Box elder bugs do not taste good, and their bright warning color announces to anybody who might try to eat them, whether it's small children or predators, don't do that again.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, and Jeff Iles, chair of the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me are Jeff Iles, chair of the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. And we are ready to take your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Before we dive into the questions, though, Donald, squash bugs seem to like these conditions as well, right?
They've done very well. And I think it's the combination of whatever happened last fall that allowed a good population of squash bugs to make it through last year. Then they survived very well through the summer or through the winter and came out this spring ready to lay their eggs. I've been at a couple of field days working with vegetable growers, and I've looked at the pumpkin patches, and the number of squash bug eggs is just astounding. It's not often that you can see them just standing looking at the plant. Usually you have to get down and turn over several leaves to find those clusters of bright red eggs that the squash bug female lays on the foliage. So if you have pumpkins and squash, you should be checking those plants, looking for the eggs. When the eggs hatch, there'll be these tiny green nymphs that begin feeding on sap. Insecticidal soap and other insecticides will do a good job of control, but you need to start early when the eggs hatch. But that's another one that has somehow been favored by the combination of weather conditions we have had.
If you can see the eggs, is there anything you can do right now?
You can pick them off, crack them, and make an omelet.
They're
very tiny omelet with very tiny eggs. You can pick off the leaves that the squash bugs are on, or you can just reach down to a thumb and finger and squash them in place. Most growers would have too many plants to do that, but in the home garden, this may be something that would be feasible to use a little mechanical control of the eggs now before the eggs hatch into the sap-feeding nymphs.
All right, we have a question from Judy, and this is for you, Donald. She says, I have a severe infestation of red-humped caterpillars on my apple trees. They've defoliated much of one tree and are starting on another. We have sprayed with malathion twice without much impact. What are your recommendations?
Malathion is not a great choice, and I hope Judy and others who have malathion on hand get it used up and never buy any more. It is legal. It is an old product that we've had around for about five decades. The disadvantages of malathion is it's weak against many of our common, especially the chewing insects. It also stinks like the dickens. And the new modern insecticides, the bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, cyhalothrin, all those things that end with the suffix THRIN, are even lower in toxicity, odorless, and more effective against a broad spectrum of insects. Well, caterpillars on an apple tree are not likely to kill the tree. The tree is not going to look good. This is a place where mechanical control might work. You might be able to shake them off and stomp on them. You might be able to pick them off. You might be able to prune off a branch where that's being defoliated. But that tree will survive, and if you have only sprayed a couple of times, it implies apples are not your livelihood, so you can probably tolerate the caterpillars, and that would be one possibility, is to tolerate them. Try mechanical control. Switch from malathion to maybe one of the other insecticides like 7 or bifenthrin or others that are labeled for apple trees, but it's a little late for control. What you see is what you're going to get, and you might be stuck with that now for the rest of the season.
All right. Our next caller is Jerry on the line from Waterloo. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, I had a question regarding watering my trees. These aren't new trees. These are well-established trees. I just want to know if it's all right for me to water them when I go out and water my plants several times a week, 2 or 3 minutes each tree on the ground, and if that's going to harm the tree or not.
Hey, Jerry, how old are these trees?
Oh, my gosh. I suppose they've been in since 40s or 50s.
40s or 50s?
1940s,
19. Oh, okay.
Really old, Jeff.
And Jerry, if I could ask one more question, what kind of trees are these? Are these oaks? Are they maples? What are they?
Elm.
Okay. You know, in that case, I'd be tempted to save my money. Elms are traditionally very tough trees. If they've been in the ground that long, they have extensive root systems, amazing root systems. In fact, the roots might extend three times the diameter of the tree canopy. And so there are two problems, or maybe more than that, but just how do you apply water to a tree that large and with a root system that extensive? You would be spending quite a bit of money. So if the trees are looking pretty good, and my guess is they probably are, then I don't know if I'd waste a whole lot, not waste time, but I don't know if I'd invest a lot of time in watering these plants. Now, of course, if the drought were to continue on into next year, then maybe my story would change, but I'm going to focus more on those young trees and maybe those in the 2 to 10 year old range. And boy, after that, I'm hoping the trees are well enough established that they don't need my help.
Well, and trees do have ways of coping with extreme weather conditions, right?
Great point, Charity. If the tree senses that it doesn't have enough water, it's going to jettison leaves. It's going to kind of hunker down, as it were, and get through the conditions. But they don't come much tougher than elms, and so that's one genus that I would probably let go.
Okay, and There was a news report that I heard the other day about the drought in Texas, saying that, the drought in Texas had been so severe that 10 to 20% of the trees in Texas had died during the drought. Is that something that, we need to be staying up at night worrying about at this point?
Charity, I guess I'd rather worry more about my mortgage and about my taxes. You know, you could stay up and worry about that kind of thing, and I do, but that's my job. But, you know, the drought in Texas, that was a horse of a different color. That was really serious. I'm hoping that this thing that we're experiencing now is short-lived. Now, famous last words, it might not be. But, yes, if the drought continues and if it's severe enough, we might lose some trees. But remember, the trees we lose might have had problems going into the drought. Trees just don't up and die for no apparent reason, or even if it's just one reason. So many trees that do succumb already have some other issues. It could be disease, it could be insect, it could be decay. There could be hundreds of reasons why trees might succumb during a drought condition. So I haven't given you a very good answer, but I'm also aware of just how difficult it is and how expensive it would be to adequately water a tree that was planted back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, or even in the 70s.
Okay. George is up next from Mason City. Hi, George.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Actually, I'm about to ask a question about trees and watering also.
All right.
Last winter, we had our oak trees trimmed during the proper months to avoid infestation with oak wilt. And the gentleman who was trimming the trees, certified gentleman, and I were talking about some of our trees, and he said, well, because we were afraid we had oak wilt already. And he said that what we had was probably bur oak blight. He used the other name for it, Tabecchia or something of that nature. Anyway, I watched a video on Iowa State's website that was very interesting. But when April and May rolled around, we had a graduation, I didn't get the trees treated. We've been watering the trees thinking that the drought is probably hard on them, stressing them further. Anyway, the guy came and said he could work us into his schedule for treatments in about 2 weeks. But I think I remember the Iowa State website saying that it's supposed to be done in like April and May. So is there any use at all to applying the chemicals? There's a ground injection and a trunk injection.
Mm-hmm.
Should we do that and hope to get some benefit from it at this point? Or should I wait until next spring?
Yeah, great questions, George. Bur oak blight has become a blight on the landscape here in the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is we have some really good people here at Iowa State that are working on the problem. Leading the charge is Dr. Tom Harrington. And I think as I'm speaking, Donna Lewis might be looking for his phone number, or maybe not. Maybe he's just tweeting over there. But Dr. Tom Harrington would be somebody that I would recommend you speak with. In my limited knowledge, I think applying the fungicides this time of the year might not have the same, you might not get the same bang for your buck that you would if they were applied during the prescribed time in April or May. So I'm going to reserve comment and recommend that you talk to Dr. Harrington and see if he can give you some more exact advice. But this is something that, if left untreated, could cause big problems for those bur oak that you have in the landscape. But check with him, and you can always call me at my office, and I can put you in touch with him. My number is 515-294-3718.
Okay, George, thanks a lot for your call. And next up is Denise on the line in Carroll. Hi, Denise.
Hi. Well, I have a question about the term gray water. And we have an iron removal system, and my husband's been trying to capture that water and water landscape. I was just wondering if it's toxic to anything and if it's a good idea, and also like air conditioning water that we've been reusing.
Right. Denise, there's a lot of interest, especially in the Southwest and in the South, for using so-called gray water, which is the result of some of the applications you've talked about. To my knowledge, there isn't anything harmful that would be harmful to your landscape plants. Boy, with that said, I guess there's always the chance for something. I worry about things like a lot of salt content in the water. That would be something, but I'm not sure what application would give rise to that kind of water condition. But I would think water from an air conditioning unit would be pretty safe to use.
That's pretty close to distilled water.
Yeah. I don't know where else you'd be getting your gray water from. Sometimes washing machines will dispense water. In that case, I'd be a little worried about some of the detergents we use. But that's a darn good question, Denise, and I don't know if I have a really good answer. But in general, gray water, there's a lot of interest in it.
Well, and Iowa State University Extension put out a publication, I think, just earlier this week with recommendations on ways to conserve water with a lot of advice about gray water. We'll put up a link to that on our Facebook page, but it's also very easy to find with Iowa State University Extension. So that might answer a few of those questions, too. Denise, thanks a lot for your call. Daryl's on the line next in Cedar Falls. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Charity, and all the others up there. I emailed last week, and of course none of you guys were there last week, but you responded. I have a pear tree that apparently has fire blight, and it sounds like this 30-foot tree is involved completely with black leaves. Is probably going to have to be cut down. And my questions start with, is there anything that I have to do about, you know, disposing of the tree? That's question number one.
Okay. Daryl, I think taking it to the landfill, take it to the place where you can take your yard waste to legally. Is the best thing you can do. But just cutting it down, getting it out of the landscape. Remember, too, that if you're going to be doing the removal, that the fire blight bacterium can be transferred to other plants on your saws. So be careful. You don't
I'm going to have the tree service take care
of
it.
Okay. So they might even chip it up for you. They'll take it away. But no,
yeah.
There's nothing else you need to do. You might have the stump ground down. You probably will have some sucker growth from the root system. You don't want that.
Yeah, no, we'll just get rid of that.
Right.
I've got another pear right next to it, and it has not been involved. So apparently that's resistant to it. But I think it was planted. It's a little bit younger than this tree. And I think it was planted as a pollinator, and because it's not been a very good bearing tree. I mean, we've only been here 3 years, but from what I can see. And my question on that one is, does that one have any longevity? I mean, is there any point in saving it?
Well, if it hasn't produced any fruit, I don't know how patient I would be. It undoubtedly is a different cultivar than the one that contracted fire blight. And perhaps its major contribution was simply providing a pollen source. So being that it's a different selection, perhaps it has better resistance to fire blight. I guess time will tell. And without knowing what it is, I don't know how to advise you.
Yeah, well, I don't either know. But, you know, I'm looking at if it is a tree that might produce at some point. I mean, you get a few pears off of it, but not much compared to the one that is going to be going. So do I just pull them both out?
Euthanizing trees, Daryl, is always dicey. So
I'm going to
leave that to you.
I'm going to
leave that one to you. But who knows? There's all kinds of reasons why trees don't bear right away. Perhaps this tree will surprise you down the road and begin bearing. But remember that pears often, in fact, always need a cross pollination.
Yeah,
or another pollinator.
By the time I get a pollinator big enough to do its work, I'm probably going to be looking at the assisted living. So
so the next owners of the property will enjoy pears.
Yeah, well, uh-huh. I mean, I can spend my time working with the apples instead.
Well, that might be a good plan, Daryl. I mean, you might plant another apple selection.
Well, hey, I don't need any more apple trees. I got three.
I'm just trying to give you more work. You know, you sound like somebody that needs a little more to do with their lives. There's always the crab apples, too, Daryl. I'm always a big fan of planting crab apples, which actually can provide a pollen source, too. They're not just pretty, you know.
Oh, well, Daryl, thanks a lot for your call. Let's try to squeeze one more call in before the break. This is John on the line from Rhodes. Hi, John.
Yes. I have a question for Donald Lewis.
Okay.
I just finished reading The Botany of Desire, The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan, and he had an essay in there about BT potatoes and the control of the Colorado potato beetle.
Mm-hmm.
And he concluded his essay by suggesting that a mature Colorado potato beetle was controlled by the BT in the green leaf potato. My understanding of BT was it only affected larvae, not mature insects. Is that the case in the potato beetle?
We're talking about different strains of BT, of course. BT is not one bacterium. It's probably hundreds of strains of bacteria, and the one that is effective against beetles is different from the BT that we normally think of as controlling caterpillars and so forth. My understanding also was that it only controlled the immature stages that are feeding on the foliage, but maybe there's something different about the BT for beetles that I need to check up on. So I'll have to say I agree with you until I find out differently.
All right, John, thanks a lot for your call. My guests today are Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, and Jeff Iles, professor and chair of the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. Our email is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, Jeff Iles, the Department Chair of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension Entomologist. And we are ready to take your calls and your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have a lot of questions on email that I want to get to. And this goes back to the box elder bugs. Carla says, we've had invasions of box elder bugs. Any little bit of dog or cat food dropped on the sidewalk or doorstep is covered with them in moments. What is more troublesome is that they are all over the ears of corn on the stalks. They seem to be seeking any cut or opening and perhaps drinking. Can you offer any suggestions to deal with the bugs on the corn?
Wow, that's a tough one because they're not supposed to be there, but they are desperate for moisture. And maybe the trees are not as full of moisture as we think, or there are so many box elder bugs that some of them got elbowed off of the trees and are now down on the flowers, on the spilled dog food, on the ears of corn. So, no, that's not supposed to happen, but since they're there, we could make some control applications. I think I would go with the least toxic alternative I can think of, and that would be insecticidal soap. This is a detergent that you buy at the garden center or the hardware store. You mix it with water according to label directions, and then you spray it on insects that are soft and slow. So it will kill box elder bug nymphs that it hits. And so your application has to be thorough, it has to be frequent, it has to be repeated, and you have to use enough pressure to get a very uniform coverage of the infested area. But insecticidal soap would be my suggestion for controlling box elder bug nymphs in places where you don't want them, recognizing there is no residual. You're going to have to keep doing it as they reappear.
All right. Next up is Tim. Hello, Tim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, how will the drought affect the butterfly population, particularly the monarchs? I tag the monarchs for Monarch Watch in late August or September every year. And just my own casual observations, I haven't seen as many monarchs around lately, and I wonder how the drought is going to affect their population and butterflies in general.
Oh, I think it's going to be harmful. I don't know how harmful it's going to be. Monarch is one that, of course, they migrate in the fall. They spend the winter in Mexico where they have to survive the ice storms and mudslides. And then when they return to Texas, they have to reproduce in order for us to get the offspring a little later in the season. They have been talking about the impact of the Texas drought on monarch butterflies as having reduced the number that we are receiving up this far north, the migrants that come back north from the Texas reproduction cycle. So if that drought has been noticeable in reducing populations, maybe ours will too. That said, as I look around the landscape, milkweed is one that is still standing upright. They still look good. They still look healthy. I wish my astilbes looked as good as the milkweeds in my lawn. So it seems like they still have a food source, but certainly drying hot winds can desiccate the eggs on the undersides of the leaves. High winds, hot weather can desiccate the small larvae as they begin to feed. I think this adds up to a potential problem, but I don't know how bad a problem it will be.
All right. Thank you for your call. Yeah. Time, I mean.
Thanks yeah,
thank
a lot
you
for your call, Tim.
Bye.
Danielle is next from Woodward. Hi, Danielle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You had a question about gray water, and we don't have the system that will bypass the water into a holding tank. We have instead been using large soft plastic buckets to collect all of the shower sink water, and that's what's keeping our annual plantings alive. And I will add the prairie and the savanna are doing quite well. But we do have some non-native plants that give us cheer, and they've benefited from this gray water system. And we get the tubs from, it's a company called Lee Valley Tool.
All right. Okay. Thanks for the tip, Danielle.
Got to use biodegradable laundry and dishwashing soap, though.
Hasn't this gotten easier with the reduction in phosphates, though, too? It's a little better now than it was in the 1988 drought when we talked about collecting your washing machine water?
Yes, I would agree with that. And we're very conscientious about what type of cleaning products we use. So actually, I think the plants are enjoying whatever's in the dish soap.
Well, and again, I mentioned that publication from Iowa State University Extension and Outreach a little while ago, and we did put a link up to that on our Facebook page. So if you want more information about doing exactly what Danielle is doing, you can find it there. And next up, we've got Cindy on the line. Hello, Cindy.
Hi. I was wondering, I had some arborvitaes, the tall, narrow ones. And this has been their third summer, and they turned brown this spring. And someone says because I didn't water them very good last fall, but they're not dead. They're not brittle like they would be dead, you know. And they're starting to come back a little bit now. Will they come all the way back if I treat them well?
Cindy, this dry condition that we're experiencing now really got its start back late last summer, fall. So perhaps the browning of the arborvitae could be traced back to some dry conditions last fall and during the winter. And as the arborvitae die, the needles or the fronds of leaves don't always turn brittle. They sometimes remain rather supple. But if you're seeing regreening, there is still some life in the plant, but to have it regain its future glory could be a stretch. So if you're one that likes to experiment, you could see what happens. But it's going to take a while for that plant to look as good as it once did. But watering something like that, a 2 or 3 year old arborvitae would be mandatory if you're going to pursue that line.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we're going to go to Tony on the line in Ames. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. I have a question about sedums. I planted some stone crop sedum last summer, and I'd never seen anything eat sedums, but suddenly something is chewing away at the leaves, and I have no idea how to fight it because I don't know what's doing it. Mm. Can you give me a hint?
My hint is, Tony, you need to spend the night in your yard. Take your flashlight out and see who's there in the middle of the night that might be eating.
Okay.
it's a little too late for the variegated cutworm, which we had more of in the springtime than we do now.
Okay.
If I just had to pick a name at random that seems highly likely, I would say earwigs.
Oh, okay.
As dry as it is, earwigs should not be surviving. They should be struggling to stay alive. And so they might be in those areas where there are succulent leaves, where there's some moisture, there's a good covering of the ground, which keeps the ground a little extra moist. And then at night, they come up and they feed on wherever they can get moisture and nutrients. So they'll feed on petunia blossoms in the middle of the night, or they'll feed on the edges of the foliage of the hostas where it touches the ground. They feed on a wide variety of things. So I would go out at night and look. If you do find earwigs, any of our yard and garden insecticides will do a good job if you get the insecticide down to where they hide. So we treat the ground under the plants, not just spraying the plants.
That
would be my guess, is strap the flashlight to the top of your head and go out and look at night to see what's out there.
Is this the Tony from Ames? Much. Tony, are you from Ames?
Yes.
I've got a confession. I sometimes sneak out at night and take cuttings from sedum, people in sedum in people's yards, and maybe you're one that I've sneaked into your. What about rabbits? That's the first thing that came to my mind. Do you think
we're just outside of Ames, so we have some nice sized hawks.
Okay.
And we have seen our rabbit population really disappear. Now we have a good squirrel population, but would squirrels attack sedums?
Oh, I don't think so. But when things get hungry and when animals get desperate, they do what we don't expect.
Right.
But as far as our usual pests like Japanese beetle, I've never seen those on sedum. Rabbit would be pretty distinctive where they would cut off the stems. And I interpreted your defoliation as a little more the edges of the leaves. So, well, either tie yourself into the garden at night to watch or set up a video camera so you can see what's going on overnight.
All right. Good luck with that, Tony. Thanks a lot for your call. And let's do a couple tomatoes questions from email. This one is from Michael in Boone. He says, I have a number of tomatoes of different cultivars. They're all planted in essentially the same location in the garden. I irrigate them an inch or so of water per week. My slicing-type tomatoes are doing just fine, but my Roma tomatoes planted alongside the others are all suffering from blossom end rot. How is this possible?
The entomologist and the tree expert are just pointing at each other at the moment.
You go, right.
You know, we were trying to get Richard on the line earlier, but he's somewhere in Alaska, I think. But, you know, I've had similar problems with mine in my garden. I've always heard Richard say that you've got to have even moisture in the soil so that doesn't happen because it's a calcium deficiency that happens when we don't have good water uptake. But Donald, that's...
Well, in addition to watering, there should be a good layer of mulch. Yeah. And when we have done those two things, it's really up to the plant to even out those moisture supplies to the fruit so that we don't get that blossom end rot. My CSA provider gave us great Roma tomatoes, so it is possible to grow them.
Now you're just gloating.
That's right.
That doesn't help.
No.
All right. Well, Pam has a strange question about her tomatoes.
Oh, good.
She says, I've been faithfully watering my tomato plants, five different heirloom varieties, and find that I have plenty of fruit on the plants, but the tomatoes are light green and don't seem to ripen. Could this be due to the extreme heat? Should I pick the green tomatoes and ripen them off the vines?
No, I would leave them, Pam, but I do think the heat has caused a lot of tomato plants to, I've used the word hunker down already, so I think they've caused them to stop being as productive as they might. My cherry tomatoes are flowering, but they refuse to set fruit, and I think the heat and the drought, or more likely the heat, has something to do with that. But
right, we've talked on the show in the past about how the extreme heat can interfere with pollination in tomatoes and corn and other things as well.
I'm just afraid that if those tomatoes are really green, they might not ripen up even when they're taken off the plant. I'd be tempted to leave them in place.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. And next on the line is Armando in Galena, Illinois. Hi, Armando.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for your program. I hope I speak clear enough because, being a foreigner. My qu- question is about hummingbirds. I live in the countryside, and I have had hummingbirds for many years. And I noticed this year in the spring, in May, that I didn't have so many. And now I would say that probably there is maybe a third of the hummingbirds I have had prior to in the years before. My question is, do you think that the Gulf situation with the steel has anything to do with that? I'm sure it's not the drought, because, you know, they usually migrate before we had drought. Mm-hmm. So anything that you can tell me? I love the hummingbirds.
All right. Thanks, Armando. They're a little bigger than insects, but anybody have any thoughts?
Well, we're going to punt to the animal ecologist, Rebecca Christoffel. Dr. Christoffel is our animal ecology expert, and her phone number is 515-294-7429. 515-294-7429. And I just think that kind of a specific question requires a specialist, and since we don't have a hummingbird specialist in the studio today, I think passing the buck to Rebecca would be our best choice.
All right. John in Davenport is up next. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, let me tell you that aside from the BBC and NPR News, you're my favorite program during the week.
Oh, thanks so much, John. What's your question?
I live in a building for the elderly and disabled inside the city. I don't have a yard. I was told a long time ago that you could grow morning glories in a window box inside your apartment in the window. Is that true?
I think you're going to have a south-facing window. They take a lot of sunshine. What do you think, Jeff?
I guess anything is possible, John, but that sounds like it'd be a real struggle. I think I'd want those plants outdoors where they could experience the natural variation in light and in temperature. I just think they'd be much more vigorous if planted outdoors.
But there are houseplants that flower that maybe could satisfy you as much, John.
Like what?
African violets spring to mind. What do you think?
I have those.
Okay.
What's the night blooming cereus called? Is it just called night blooming
cereus? Oh, I have an epithelium.
Yeah.
I got a cutting. The darn thing's rooted, but it hasn't put forth any branches yet.
Yeah, I think that one takes a while. The other one that came to mind, what about orchids? Have you gone down that challenging route yet?
I feel over-challenged.
I tell you, I agree. Orchids scare me. I see them at the store. I think, wow, I could do that. And I just know I'll bring them home and the cats will eat the blossoms, and it'll be the last blossoms I ever see on that poor plant.
You know, John, we have a bird of paradise in our atrium in Horticulture Hall, which is a wonderful plant, and what a strange flower it produces. That would be another interesting one, but I'd stick with those that are meant to be used indoors, I think.
Well, John, thanks a lot for your call, and good luck with that. And we are out of time for questions today. A lot of people have a lot of questions. I think we're all working hard just to keep things alive this year. Jeff Iles, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Charity. Good to be here.
Jeff Iles, professor and chair of the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Charity.
Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension Entomologist. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Alyssa Weiss in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on the show, we'll talk with Lisa Knopp. Her latest book is What the River Carries: Encounters with the Mississippi, Missouri, and Platte. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Have a great weekend.